I'm dropping an episode today because I had the opportunity this week to collaborate with another unsolved true crime podcast called Coffee and Cases. We explored the disappearance of Prisma Denise Peralta Reyes, which is a case that has stuck with me since I heard about it years ago, and I would love to see resolution for Prisma's family. Allison, one of the hosts of Coffee and Cases, did all the research, and I was pretty much in the role that Sean is in when we record. I will say, I appreciate Sean's position so much more than I did before, because it is harder than you'd think to keep track of all the facts and the dates and the times, and yeah, I kept up, but it was just harder than I expected. I hope you check out Coffee and Cases because they put in a lot of effort into their cases and they frequently work with family members of victims and law enforcement, which I admire. So anyway, we will be putting out a regular episode on Sunday, but for now, I hope you enjoy this episode.
It's always the not knowing that lingers in unseen corners, waiting for the moment when you think you've moved on or that your heart has finally toughened, so the pain isn't so debilitating. And then that's when it hits again. The only pain that compares to the loss of a child is that of not knowing what happened to them. Should you grieve and move on to spare others who need your attention and love? Or do you give in to the all-encompassing compulsion to keep looking and never to stop, no matter the cost? Those were the options on the table for the family at the center of our case this week, and various members made different decisions. Some have given up hope of a joyful reunion. Others, like Dan Fuchs, refuse to stop believing that that kind of joy, of a child returning home, is still possible. He won't stop believing that his stepdaughter could still be alive, and that what she would need is someone else believing in her ability to come back home. This is the case of Prisma Denise Peralta Reyes. I am so excited to be collaborating this week with Sam from Key to the Case podcast. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, thank you, Allison.
Yeah, would you mind telling us just a little bit about yourself and about your podcast?
Yeah, definitely. So as you said, my name is Sam. I started an unsolved true crime podcast called Key to the Case with my fiance, Sean, about 4 months ago. So we're still really new. but the presentation is similar to Coffee and Cases. Each week, I research a different disappearance, unsolved murder, or suspicious death. And then I share the case with Sean and we discuss it. We really try to focus on lesser known cases, cases that are underreported. And we've actually had several listeners tell us that they haven't heard of many of the cases we have covered. So definitely check out Key to the Case wherever you listen to podcasts. A couple of episodes that could be a good starting point, I think, would be episode 15, the Diane Wolfe case, or episode 12, the Lisa Grary and Brandon Rumbaugh case. Those, I think, are definitely on the lesser known side.
Yeah, I've never heard of either one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And definitely feel free to start anywhere. But Allison, I really want to thank you for this opportunity to discuss Prisma's case with you. I love Coffee and Cases, and I think you and Maggie are a wonderful team.
Aww,
plus, the research you guys do is top notch.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, so Sleuth Hounds, the way this will work, Sam will actually play the role of Maggie, even though it was actually Sam. She doesn't know all the details of the case, but Sam is the one who gave a few case suggestions for this episode. And actually, I don't know if I told you this, Sam, but as soon as I started researching, I knew that this was the one that I needed to cover, because just recently I covered the case of Lauren DiMaulo. And when I covered that case, I said that when I had started researching it, I felt like I was kind of led by fate to cover it, because Lauren and another case that we had covered, Andrea Knabel, which that was a local case, another one that we've covered on the show, both of those women appeared on the same People magazine cover for Missing Moms. And guess who else was on that same cover?
Oh my gosh. Prisma.
Yes. Yes, crazy. Prisma was also on that cover. So as soon as you suggested it, I was like, okay, this is it.
Yeah, and it's one of those cases that sticks with you. I don't even remember how I heard about it years ago, but I did, and I just could not forget it. And it's just so startling, the whole case. So we'll get into all of that, though.
Yeah, and I actually had the pleasure of receiving additional information in document form from a private investigator in the case and to speak with Prisma's stepfather, Dan Fuchs, in preparation for this episode. So just like I try to do, interspersed throughout, you will hear segments of that interview. Prisma Denise Peralta Reyes was born in Veracruz, Mexico. According to the Crime Wire, Prisma's father actually died not long after she was born. And after that, Prisma lived with her grandmother, while Prisma's mother, Lilia, cared for her other children. Prisma was 4 when her mother, Lilia, met an American named Dan Fuchs. This was around 2000 or 2001, and the two began a relationship. And during their relationship, Dan recalled to me the first time he met Lilia's mother and Prisma. They had actually taken a bus ride for the trip, and he recalled seeing Prisma standing there with her grandmother waving as they exited the bus. And when it was time for Dan and Lilia to return home, he remembered Prisma wanting to go with them, but that her grandmother didn't want to let her go.
Oh,
I know. Can you imagine having to say no?
I know. It was so hard.
I know. It was actually about 6 months later, Dan told me, that Prisma called her mom and said again that she wanted to come and live with them. So Dan convinced Lilia that Prisma joining her siblings would actually be for the best. And they went to go pick Prisma up, but she didn't know they were coming.
Oh, that's sweet. So they surprised her.
Yes. Prisma's grandmother's voice actually echoed through the open doorway when they arrived, telling Prisma what to get at the store. And the front tire of Prisma's bicycle peeked out the door. But when Prisma actually spotted the pair, she dropped her bike, she dropped everything she was carrying, and she came running into her mother's arms.
Oh my gosh. Well, I can imagine that was a good feeling for her mother.
Yes,
too.
Yes. That was when she learned that she was actually going to be going back to Juarez with them. They enrolled Prisma in local schools in Juarez, and within a few months, Dan told me, they were actually able to get the paperwork approved for all of them to move back to the States. So it seems like it moved pretty quickly once they got Prisma.
Yeah.
With them.
That's good, because I imagine it doesn't always move that quickly, that kind of process.
I would think it is very slow. So Prisma was still very young when the family moved to the United States, and when they arrived, they were enrolling the children, obviously, in school here, and the school actually wanted to hold Prisma back a year, not because she tested at any level or anything like that, but they said that, this is what Dan told me, that the schools in Mexico weren't as good as the schools in the United States. So they wanted to hold her back a year. Yeah. And Dan told me that Prisma's mother was actually going to listen to them, which I get, you know, if you've got a school telling you this. But Dan stepped in and he asked that they just give Prisma a shot before making that judgment. And Sam, to show how bright Prisma is, according to Dan, he said that Prisma learned English in one summer.
Wow, that's really impressive.
I have been doing Duolingo Spanish for almost a year, and I can probably say about 50 words. So,
seriously, I mean, I took all throughout high school, I took Spanish. Even in elementary school, we took Spanish classes, and I did not pick it up as quickly as she did English.
Yeah.
That is impressive.
And English is harder.
So, yeah, exactly.
Kudos to Prisma. But not only did she do that, she actually received a scholarship, I read in one article, to a math and science magnet school called Kemp High School. And she graduated high school a year early.
Good for her.
Yeah, she had joined the National Guard and become a private first class. And she had gone to Kaplan to become a paralegal. So this girl has her act together.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that's an interesting transition, too, from the National Guard to being a paralegal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, well, I'll get to all of the jobs that Prisma held here in just a second. She was quite busy with all of her jobs. And obviously, as you can tell by her drive, Prisma was determined in everything she did. She was headstrong and she was forthcoming. Here is what Dan told me when asked about her personality.
Very giving, very intelligent. She didn't take flack from nobody. She didn't like to take flack from nobody. She would tell you what she thought when she thought it. But other than that, very outgoing. Very, very outgoing.
It seems that because she was so headstrong, she did sometimes butt heads with her mother. I have a teenager. I totally get this. The butting heads. So not long after Dan and Lilia actually ended their relationship, Prisma ran away from home. Because, again, she and her mom butted heads. Dan came back to help look for Prisma, and he actually found her and brought her home. And he told me that when he did, he said something to the effect of, because she was out of high school at this point, "You're an adult now. If you don't want to be here, you can tell us that you don't want to be here. Go through the door. Don't go sneaking through the window."
Yeah. And as hard as that is to hear sometimes when you're that age, I think it, if she had time to think about it, I'm sure she thought, okay, I respect Dan and my mom, and I shouldn't have done that. And maybe she wouldn't have liked it in the moment, but I definitely think it would have resonated with her for sure.
Right. Yeah. And she actually did move shortly after that. And when she did, she met and began a relationship with a man named Arturo. This was while she was going to school at Kaplan to become a paralegal when she was dating Arturo, that she found out that she and Arturo were expecting a child together. She gave birth to a son, Dominic, in 2014, who quickly became her world.
Aww.
Sadly, before Dominic's birth, about 6 months into the pregnancy, Arturo kicked Prisma out of the apartment that they shared at the time. By the time that Dominic was born, Prisma was a single mom. And she wanted to be the best mom that she could be and provide everything for her son. But obviously now she was having to start at square one.
Right. And do we know if there was kind of a history between Arturo and Prisma throughout their whole relationship, or was it more so toward the end that things started going awry?
I got the feeling that it was more toward the end of their relationship. And if you recall, Sam, how I just mentioned Prisma's drive, you could also see it in the fact that Prisma held down multiple jobs at any given time. She took being able to provide for herself and Dominic as her personal mission. Asked how Prisma was as a mother, Dan told me the following.
She always tried to move forward, do better for herself. So by doing better for herself, she did better for her son. And that was her whole goal, to make his life easy. You know, she just wanted him to have a good, easy life.
To do so, Prisma worked many, many jobs. One of those jobs was selling insurance. Yet another was at a gentleman's club. One was in the cafeteria at her son Dominic's school. And still another that she had at one point was at a used car dealership. And she began that last job in 2018. And was holding it when the incident that we are going to explore today happened. So I know I jumped through several years there from 2014 through 2018. But during that time, nothing really seemingly eventful happened. Just her grinding away to make a good life for Dominic. So at the time when our case takes place, Prisma was living in Mesquite, Texas, a city of roughly 150,000 that is part of the Dallas-Fort Worth region and situated just east of Dallas. Now, I need to backtrack a little bit, Sam, before continuing to introduce another character who entered Prisma's life in 2016, but who was back in her life in 2019. You see, Prisma began dating a much older man in 2016, mm-hmm. named Ryan. Dan told me that Ryan was roughly 12 to 14 years Prisma's senior. Unfortunately, though, Sam, similar to Arturo, Prisma and Ryan also had a turbulent relationship. Even in the first year of dating, police were called about a domestic violence issue involving Ryan and Prisma. As a result, Ryan was charged. This was based on the bruises covering Prisma's body with assault.
Wow. That's terrible.
Yes. He actually received a lesser charge, but that incident effectively ended their relationship, and both of them began dating other people. In February 2019, however, Prisma and Ryan began talking again.
Do you know who started the relationship back up or who reached out to who?
I do not know whether it was Prisma trying to rekindle or mm-hmm. Ryan trying to rekindle. I do know that there were some family members like Dan who were completely unaware that the two began dating again. In fact, Dan said that he never even met Ryan when they previously dated, nor in early 2019. So he's never met him.
Not a great sign. And I definitely think if they started rekindling, maybe she wouldn't want to tell her family that, because if they knew about what happened before, mm-hmm. even if they hadn't met him, if they knew about what happened before, they're not going to support that relationship. And that never. Is a hard conversation to have.
Right. And Dan told me as well that Prisma was actually very selective about whom she brought around him, because he's her dad figure. You know, she called him dad.
Right.
So what Prisma had told Dan about, this was about a month before she went missing. So now we're in March 2019. So Prisma and Ryan started to talk again February 2019. In March 2019, right before Prisma went missing, she felt like she was being followed by someone or stalked by someone.
Did she give any details to anyone?
She did say that whomever was doing it kind of left the quote-unquote message that she was in danger by slashing her tires.
Oh.
I mean, I would be terrified, but I'm a scaredy cat.
That's scary,
anyway,
yeah. And are we talking like all four tires were slashed?
Yes.
Wow. Well, one, that's scary. Two,
right.
That's irritating. Now you have to get all new tires.
Yes, like, which are expensive.
Yes. I'm seeing dollar signs just thinking about that.
And here you're a single mom working multiple jobs just to provide a good life. This is not a bill you want.
In some of the cases we've covered, I think maybe two, we've talked about someone who felt like they were being followed, but then they didn't really have any like evidence, I guess, mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. explain why they felt that way. Well, in this case, you have Prisma, who her tires were slashed. That's an intentional act likely done by the person who was following her.
Yes. Now, I'll give you a little teaser here. I'll get to it in a minute. We think we know who slashed the tires.
Oh, okay.
But Dan spoke with Prisma on March 20th, which was her 26th birthday.
Okay, that's my birthday. I didn't really share a birthday.
Wow. Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, he texted her, and she texted back, "Love you too, Dad, and miss you too." And although her texts to Dan were normal, Prisma's birthday present for herself wasn't a typical one. Due to the tire slashing, Prisma had decided to purchase herself a gun.
Mm.
While she told Dan that she bought the gun only because it was her constitutional right as a United States citizen and that she wanted one, She had told others that it was for protection because she was being stalked.
Yeah, so it sounds like the anxiety was pretty heightened at that point. Do you know if that was the first time she'd ever owned a gun?
I know that she had shot guns before because, number one, in her experience with the National Guard.
Right.
And number two, Dan told me that she would kind of come out to his property and they would shoot guns together. So she knew how to handle a gun, but I don't know if she owned a handgun prior to this.
Okay. I was just thinking if this, it's even worse if this is the first time ever that she's owned one personally.
Right.
So, yeah.
So now, Sam, we have arrived at the day upon which every detail hinges, the day that Prisma disappeared, April 17th, 2019. So we're not even a month after she had bought the gun for herself for her birthday.
Yep.
According to all accounts, Prisma arrived early that morning for her job at the car lot. It was called 123 Texas Auto. But that choice to arrive early actually ended up leading to some problems. She had taken a prime parking spot since she got to work early enough, but she ended up getting into an argument with a coworker who accused Prisma of stealing her parking spot, though obviously no parking spots were assigned at the lot.
Yeah, that's incredibly weird to me. I do remember this detail of this story. I just don't understand getting so worked up over a parking spot. And
I don't either.
A terrible way to start your day off, right? Someone, first of all, like having conflict with someone you worked with is never ideal, but over something so small, something that I can't imagine ever getting mad over.
I know. It's just
so irritating.
Park in the spot beside of it. I mean,
yeah,
it's five
what's
feet
the
further.
Big deal? I don't understand.
Yeah. So after the argument, Prisma told her supervisors about it and went back to her normal work. When Prisma left the car lot for lunch between noon and one, she actually did so with a purpose, Sam. She was going to meet someone. So on her lunch break, she headed to E-Bar Tex-Mex restaurant in the 1900 block of Haskell Avenue in Dallas. She went there to meet her ex, Ryan.
And at this point, they'd kind of been talking
right
up to this, right?
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Mm-hmm. She called him on her way at 1:12, and she arrived at E-Bar sometime around 1:30. While at the bar, this is about to get really weird. Ryan, who had arrived almost an hour earlier before Prisma got there, had actually given the bartender a fake name, telling them that his name was Matt.
Why is he even telling them his name in the first place?
I don't know.
I'm trying to think, like, okay, if I go to a bar, I don't feel like I typically give my name out. But
right.
Beside the point, that is strange in and of itself.
Yeah, I had no idea the significance of that detail, if there even is any, but I found it odd enough that I just wanted to have it noted because it's so bizarre.
I will keep that.
File it away, Sam. File it away. Yeah. Regardless of the validity of that detail, the lunch date between Prisma and Ryan did not go smoothly. Prisma's just having a bad day from the start.
Yeah.
It seems that after Prisma took a phone call outside, that Ryan said something to the effect of, if we're going to get back together, then you can't be talking to other guys.
Ew,
but I think the call was for her work.
Together yet.
Right.
Yeah. They were probably calling her asking where she was, would imagine.
And
he's
already being possessive. So.
Yep. Yeah.
The exact details of the interaction between Prisma and Ryan at the bar are a little fuzzy, but Ryan is seen, according to Mesquite Police Detective Dustin Barrett, on the bar's camera footage. He is seen leaving the bar. Prisma, however, comes back inside the bar and stays for another 3 hours after Ryan left.
Wow. Okay, so at that point, it seems like somewhere along the way, she made the decision to not return to work that day?
Yes. And okay. Sometime while at the bar, whether this is before or after Ryan left, Prisma called her son Dominic's babysitter named Maria. Now, typically, when Prisma would call the babysitter Maria, based upon past calls, conversations with her would last, you know, 5-10 minutes. This particular phone call lasted 52 minutes, which was a stark contrast to the norm.
Yeah, I would say so. And yes. This was, you said, still at the bar, right?
Yes.
And do you know, maybe you'll get into this, but do we know what they were talking about?
Yes. So when Maria was asked what they talked about, she said, well, we just talked a little bit about what happened at work. We talked about the upcoming Easter holiday. And Prisma told me that she would be here at the normal time of 7:30 to pick up Dominic. Which doesn't sound like it would last 52 minutes.
No. I mean, you'd have to try really hard to make those topics extend out for 52 minutes. I mean, did she talk at all about the mood Prisma was in or kind of the state of mind at that point?
Not. She will later, but still seemingly kind of downplaying it. And making it sound like, you know, she was a little miffed about what happened at work. But other than that, you know, everything's fine. So Maria's child and Dominic went to the same school. So Maria would pick both the children up and then watch Dominic every day until 7:30 when Prisma could come and pick him up after work. And I asked Dan how Prisma knew Maria. And he told me that Maria and Prisma's mother had known each other, and that was how Prisma had met her.
Oh, okay.
After the phone call, Prisma re-entered the bar and had another drink. Eventually, something happens between Prisma and the bartender. Reportedly, the bartender refused to continue serving Prisma more drinks. And they had a verbal altercation. And Prisma, visibly upset, left the bar around 5 p.m.
Do you know how much she had to drink while she was there? Is it like an estimate, maybe?
That is a great question. And I actually asked that same question. We do not know. I have not seen it reported that the bartender, you know, gave a tally or anything like that.
Well, you know, the first thing I'm thinking of is if she used her credit card or debit card there, like that total should give you a sense of some sort. If it's really large, like for one person, I don't know, $80 to $90 or something, okay, then there's some concern there. But it also seems like if the bartender's cutting her off, then okay, she's probably had quite a bit to drink at that point, I would think.
Right. And Sam, while I didn't see this in any of my research, a document that was provided from the private investigator notes that there is a possibility that, and this is another one of those odd details, I just want you to file away. There's a possibility that after Prisma left the bar, right around 5, that she may have tried to hide behind some dumpsters near the bar before leaving the bar itself.
Okay.
So,
I will file that away. That's interesting.
Obviously, this behavior would have been very out of character for Prisma. According to Dan, and then I'll play an audio clip. He basically said he had gone to lunch or dinner with her so many times. And he was like, I'm telling you, she could handle her liquor. He was like, I have seen her drink very heavily before. So for her to get to the point where somebody's having to cut her off was not like her.
I know for a fact she could handle our liquor because we've been out, you know, she used to come over and we used to go out to lunch on a regular basis and or go out to dinner and stuff, you know, every couple of weeks. And I've seen her, you know, pretty heavily drinking before.
Mm-hmm.
And that just didn't seem right. You know, I mean, it seemed to be as if she, something was definitely wrong with her.
But I feel like I also know people who they can drink a lot, but then mm-hmm. once they hit a certain point, they right. just totally kind of spiral. So they go from seeming so normal, but then they hit a certain point and then it's like a problem. But that is good to know, I guess, right. that she could drink a lot and right. could handle her liquor. That's interesting.
What happened next was even more unusual, given the person that Prisma's family knew her to be. After she left the bar near Haskell Avenue and Main Street at just after 5 p.m., remember, she leaves the bar at 5, this was at like 5:06, Prisma was involved in yet another altercation. In the 100 block of North Haskell Avenue, three separate women made reports of a woman matching Prisma's description and a white Jeep matching Prisma's vehicle about a woman who pulled a gun on them during an incident of road rage. They even got her license plate number, and it was indeed Prisma's license plate.
Oh, okay, super alarming. My first question is, so they all got out of the car, and that's when she pulled the gun, or was it from inside the car? Not that it makes it better, but I'm just curious.
I will give you the complete description. Here we go. So before I do that, Dan actually told WFAA reporter David Goins, quote, I'm at a loss. I don't know what was going through her head, end quote. So here is the narrative, Sam, from the statement that was taken from one of the people who made the report. Quote, Detective Jones spoke to complainant McCray, who stated she was traveling on Haskell Avenue and the suspect's vehicle, meaning Prisma's, swerved into her lane. Complainant McCray stated she honked her horn and the suspect began yelling at her while driving. Complainant McCray stated they approached a red light and came to a stop. Complainant McCray stated the suspect almost hit the vehicle in front of her. Complainant McCray stated the suspect exited her vehicle with a handgun and approached the window while pointing the gun at her. Complainant McCray stated that she feared for her life, so she drove through the red light and several other red lights for safety. Complainant McCray stated the suspect appeared to be under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Complainant McCray stated the suspect was the sole occupant inside the suspect vehicle, end quote.
A lot to take in there.
Yes.
Wow. I don't want to speculate too much, but you do wonder if, well, first of all, I think the alcohol is a factor here, but I'm also mm-hmm. picturing, so this would be extremely out of character for her. I'm thinking if I did something like this, how confused my family would be. So I'm also right. picturing being Dan in this situation or mm-hmm. any of her family members, how concerning this is and just perplexing. Like, what right. was going on? So, I mean, I guess the alcohol could be a factor, but what else beyond that? You know, right. is there a chance she thought this was one of the people following her? Was she super confused? And then you also have to factor in the day's events already. Like, we already mm-hmm. have three right? negative mm-hmm. things happening that morning
yes.
at work. And then she goes to the bar and has the issues with Ryan. And
yep.
then the bartender cuts her off and it's all just adding up.
Yes.
Not necessarily like it adds up to where she ended up, but it,
right.
it just keeps piling up these like negative events.
Yes. And you know, you said it's hard to imagine what Dan was feeling, hearing.
Yeah.
About this episode. And Dan actually gave me a very different perspective of Prisma to keep in mind. Again, this is his image of Prisma, but something very much at odds with the report.
And I'm still, you know, like all those reports of the, you know, her brandishing her handgun mm-hmm. and everything in traffic. That kind of struck me as odd too, because she was not that irresponsible. Yeah, she was going to brandish a firearm. She knew what to do with it. She was going to do what it was meant to do.
Right.
Yeah, she wouldn't have just, you know, brandish it just to say, hey, leave me alone here. I'm going to show you this gun. Get away from me.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't have done that. She would have, even going through the military now, she would have been trained and everything through them. She would have used it for its meant purpose. And, you know, she's been out here at my farm. Even when she lived here, she would go out and she'd, you know, practice shoot and everything else, and she's very responsible, you know, with it, very, very cautious, and all that on it. So she knows what it would do and what it was meant for, and right. I don't believe she would have just, you know, pulled it out just for the heck of it.
That's a really good point. I didn't even think about that perspective of someone who has experience with firearm.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, you're not going to wield it around like that.
Right. Yeah. Brandish it, you know, in the middle of an intersection.
Yeah. Yeah.
By the time police responded to the call, Prisma was gone. We know the following details because of information from Prisma's phone pings after the incident. Prisma had gotten back into her Jeep and headed back toward Mesquite and the car lot before turning around and heading back again toward Dallas. Even though she made some phone calls during that time, I actually haven't seen any details concerning whether Prisma told anyone why she decided to turn around. I mean, if I'm thinking logically, it could be what you referenced earlier, that she just realized, you know, things are not going to be very pleasant if I return to the car lot after having been gone for so many hours when I mm-hmm. really only left for lunch. That alone obviously would make me want to turn around and just, you know, call the job a loss at this point.
Right. And the workday is probably almost over at that point.
Right. Yeah. I obviously don't want to say that she turned around because of the road rage incident, because why would she drive back in the direction of the incident rather exactly. than away? So there has to be another reason, it seems to me. Fox 4 News reported that investigators for local law enforcement think Prisma was driving on I-30 before doubling back. They said, quote, she heads out toward White Rock Lake. We have her turning around near White Rock Lake and coming back this way. And then she ends up at the apartment complex over there, end quote. But when I spoke to Dan, he feels that since I-30, I don't know much about interstates in Texas, but I-30 is an elevated highway and the exits are quite some distance apart. He says there's no way Prisma was on that interstate. He believes instead that she was on a road that ran parallel to it and a road on which she, you know, the turnaround would have been possible. I also asked Dan because I was looking at a timeline of the day and I noticed that we have a gap between when Prisma leaves the road rage scene to the time that she is caught on cameras at the apartment complex that was mentioned in that quote from the detective. So I ask him about this gap because it was something like 35 minutes in a drive that should have only taken her 8.
Okay.
So I ask him about this gap in time that didn't match up with how long it would have taken her to get back when she turned around. She actually did make some phone calls during that gap. She called her friend Juan at 5:25. She called Ryan at 5:27. And then she called Ryan again at 5:28. So I was talking to Dan and I said, you know, do you think maybe, because we're trying to figure out what happened to her that day, right? Where she is gone. So I said, do you think she went somewhere else? Do you think she could have pulled over to the side of the road to talk on the phone? But Dan actually clarified for me.
She made several calls in that time, and she also turned around a couple times in her driving pattern. She made a couple rounds, you know, driving forward, turning back, driving forward, turning back, driving forward, turning back.
Oh, that's so strange.
Yeah. So whatever options she was weighing in her mind, she was clearly unsure of the right choice. Hmm. But perhaps Ryan knows the reason that Prisma was indecisive and finally actually turned around towards Dallas, because after she turned around, she went straight to an apartment complex that was called at the time Olympus on Ross. It is now called McAllen on Ross, located in the 3500 block of Roseland Avenue, which was Ryan's apartment complex.
Hmm.
She arrived there, Sam, around 5:47.
Okay.
Now, again, she leaves the road rage incident. It's like 5:09. She gets to his apartment complex at 5:47. And like I said, it should have, according to calculations, only have taken about 8 minutes to get there. But obviously, there's a 38-minute gap. But I'm going to tell you more about what happens at the apartment complex here in just a minute. Hours later, a 911 call came in to Mesquite Police around 9:30 p.m. from Dominic's babysitter to report that Prisma was at least 2 hours late in picking up her son. Officers arrived at Maria's home to take a missing persons report. The babysitter, Maria, told police that Prisma had called her earlier that afternoon, but that nothing major seemed to be bothering Prisma. However, she hadn't shown up to pick up her son, and that was completely out of character. So the narrative of the incident report reads in part, quote, "It was very unusual for Reyes not to pick up her child," and that, quote, "they were worried that something had happened to her, and that was when the complainant called 911," end quote. So a detail that stood out to me, Sam, but I don't know what to do with it, mm-hmm. is that the report says, quote, "The complainant stated to Officer Solano that she had been texting Reyes at around 1600 hours and that Reyes told the complainant that she was having difficulty with parking at work," end quote. Now, obviously, we know that the conversation was a phone call and not a text, but this could have just been miscommunication, since the original officer who arrived to take the missing persons report actually had to call in Officer Solano, since Solano is a Spanish speaker and Maria solely speaks Spanish. So maybe he just didn't catch the mistaken detail in the narrative.
Yeah. Or I was thinking, I mean, maybe they did have the phone call and they texted about it. I didn't know if that was an option, but something like that.
Yeah. The next call related to Prisma came in the next day on April 18th about a white Jeep Wrangler blocking an alleyway. The connection with Prisma actually wasn't immediate, however, since the Wrangler was actually not registered to Prisma, but to a male, someone who had, according to CrimeWire, been married for 10 years, but with whom Prisma was still in contact and had at one time believed that he was her boyfriend before finding out that he had a wife. This guy who she thought was her boyfriend had bought her a Jeep, but it was in his name. And then she finds out that he has a wife. But Prisma had, according to that same article in CrimeWire by Jade Hassan Plug, called the man among the other calls that she had made just before she disappeared. So she's still in contact with him.
Yeah. And do you know if he answered the phone call?
I do not know. But I do know that during my discussion with Dan, Prisma believed that the person who had slashed her tires was this man's wife.
Oh.
So that explains the tire slashing. Yes.
That kind of threw me for a loop. So, I mean, she would have motive to do that, right? Or just seek revenge if this person and is if her husband is still talking to Prisma. That I guess would make sense then. Yeah,
and remember, that's why, because she thought she was being stalked, that she had purchased the handgun for protection. And Sam, that handgun was still visible in the now abandoned Jeep.
Okay, so when she got out of the Jeep,
yes,
she just left it in there. So it kind of makes you think, I don't know if it makes me think this, but kind of like she felt safe in that moment, or she didn't feel the need to bring it with her, or maybe she just forgot. In the state she was in, I don't know that she was able to think 100% clearly at that point. So maybe it, you know, just got left behind. I don't know.
So that obviously could be it. It could be, you know, the fact that she parked so haphazardly, you know, blocking a road.
Yeah.
In addition to the fact that she left her protection behind, it at least indicated to her family that Prisma was either in a hurry when she got out of her Jeep, or that she didn't think that she was going to be gone for very long.
Yeah, that both of those scenarios make sense.
So, Sam, let's go through the details of what happened once Prisma arrived at the apartment complex that law enforcement have been able to piece together based upon phone calls and CCTV footage taken within the complex. So first, around 5:47, Prisma abandoned her Jeep haphazardly and ran into the gated apartment complex behind a car that had just entered.
So she wouldn't have been able to enter if she didn't do that.
Yes. Okay. She immediately, on CCTV footage, turns toward the elevators where she was again caught on camera at 5:49. Prisma is seen on her cell phone, and based on records, detectives were able to verify that many calls were made between 5:49 and 6:01 p.m. alone when Prisma was seen on the surveillance footage. So she's standing there for about 12 minutes. At least half of those calls were to Ryan, at least one to an ex-boyfriend, and one to a photographer friend. Nearly every call lasted 3 minutes or less, with most right about 1 minute long. Two calls were made at 5:49, one at 5:54, one at 5:57, another at 5:58, one at 5:59, one at 6 o'clock, and one at 6:01.
And it sounds like these are mostly being answered. Is that right? If they're lasting
a very short time. And near the end of that series of phone calls, Prisma was even confusing who she was speaking with. One caller, she continually called Ryan and kept demanding that he give her his apartment number. But the person she was speaking with was not Ryan.
Oh.
Yeah. Dan told reporter Rebecca Lopez for WFAA.com, quote, "She was confused. She didn't know what was going on. She thought she was talking to one person, but she was actually talking to someone else," end quote. And I asked Dan to whom Prisma was speaking when she said that she didn't feel right, because I had read in my research that she said to at least one person that she just didn't feel right, that something wasn't normal. And it was actually a friend who lived out of state who, when she said, you know, something is going on, I feel abnormal, he asked Prisma to drop a pin. This was very smart since he was out of state. Drop a pin and he would have someone come and get her to check on her.
Yeah, that's really nice.
Prisma, though, never got a chance to drop that pin.
And not to assume, but maybe in her state, she wouldn't be able to do that quickly or like know how to do that. I'm even thinking right now, like, how do I drop a pin?
Do I know how? Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm like, honestly, it may have just gone, it's a great idea, but it may have gone past her. I don't know.
But Dan also clarified for me that in nearly every conversation she had during that time, she indicated that something was wrong. So the comments to everyone that she spoke with, and the fact that she had a friend who told her to drop the pen, indicates to me that she was scared enough that she conveyed that she needed help.
Right. And these conversations are all happening in front of the elevator, right?
Yes.
She wasn't going anywhere. She was just staying, or she was stationary and then making these phone calls.
Yeah. She's not going anywhere yet. The footage shows Prisma being very dramatic with her arm movements, kind of fidgeting with her lanyard and her keys. And it's actually an animated action that Dan said that he had seen before. I mean, I totally get this because I tend to be very animated when I talk, especially when I feel, you know, an extreme emotion. So I get it. But law enforcement have stated that she obviously appears intoxicated, which makes sense based on what we learned from the events at E-Bar, and that she was upset and crying. But Dan actually believes that she had more than alcohol in her system.
I think she was drugged. She was roofied or something like that. Something was slipped to her somehow, somewhere or another. And the detective said, no, there ain't no way. There's no way possible. It's no way possible. That she might have been doing that, because everybody that I talked to, that, or the people that she contacted and called, they all said she sounded very confused and not knowing where she was at.
Mm-hmm.
Which could be, here again, you know, if she was slipped something or something like that, she would, you know, normally, you know, you would know where you're at.
Yeah. So that's, what do you think about that? I mean, my concern is, like, the video footage, wouldn't that have caught someone doing that? Because there's footage from the bar, right?
There is, which I'm sure that law enforcement have seen the whole thing, but I know that the family hasn't, the private investigator hasn't. She's actually requested it and not received it yet. So, that's a really good question. And I mean, obviously you don't want to believe that your daughter could act this out of character. So I totally get that. Part of me, mm-hmm. and we'll get to it in the theories, wonders though if there is something to his gut feeling.
I totally see where he's coming from, because this mm-hmm. is all really strange mm-hmm. behavior. Very. And it doesn't make sense for her. It doesn't. It seems really extreme for someone who has just been drinking all day. But then I've seen people very intoxicated before, too. So at the same time, I can see a scenario where it was just that.
Right. So law enforcement have stated that they followed up with all of the individuals with whom Prisma spoke after leaving E-Bar. And they indicated that Prisma was upset, and police have actually said that they know what Prisma was upset about, but have declined to comment on exactly what that was, which is odd to me, Sam, because I feel like if it was just the argument at work that everybody already knows about, they would tell us that.
Yeah. And even if it weren't, it's like, what evidence are you holding back by not saying what she was upset mm-hmm. about? I understand holding back information for the sake of the investigation, but saying what she was upset about, I really wonder mm-hmm. why they would feel the need to hold that back, especially when they have given other information in this case that I think maybe they would hold back.
Right.
But they didn't.
Details.
So then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting.
Prisma's phone, nor her debit or credit card, were used after that day. Various agencies were brought in to aid in the search for Prisma, and police explored all leads that the case brought in, but unfortunately, none of those leads seemed to guide them to any solid answers. The last that Prisma was seen, she just saunters off to the side of the camera's view. But if she didn't take these elevators, though I don't understand why she wouldn't have, since she's standing right in front of them, then I can only assume that she had taken stairs or taken another set of elevators in the complex's parking garage, neither of which have surveillance cameras, because someone reported seeing her in the parking garage. So why not take the elevators that are right in front of her?
Yeah, that is strange.
Seems very weird. We assume that she obviously got above the first floor somehow, because as reported by Luke Kenton from The Sun, Detective Barrett also stated that eyewitnesses reported seeing Prisma on both the fourth and fifth floor of the apartment complex's parking garage in a, until then, never before seen video clip that was shown on ABC 8 news coverage by Rebecca Lopez of Prisma's case that aired on April 18th, 2022. Surveillance footage from the parking garage shows a woman dressed just like Prisma who, off in the distance, is walking across the screen before again disappearing.
Did the people who saw her, did they talk with her at all, or they just saw her?
One did, that I will tell you about in just a moment. So where she went this time after she exited the screen, we don't know. Detective Barrett did tell Maria Guerrero of the Dallas-Fort Worth NBC affiliate, quote, "There were several exits not covered by surveillance video," end quote. So obviously he's meaning somehow that either Prisma took one of those exits that weren't covered by surveillance video, or that someone could have taken Prisma elsewhere without video surveillance catching them. But I wonder, I mean, if this is true, obviously we have to assume that whoever took her has a working knowledge of the apartment complex, because I would imagine that if they knew where cameras were, then they had to have known, more importantly, where cameras weren't.
Oh, so you don't think it could have been happenstance? Like, you're thinking it would have been more intentional.
Right. So if someone did take Prisma, no matter what theory we believe, either Prisma willingly going someplace or someone taking her maliciously, it was done off camera.
Right.
So there had to have been a working knowledge of where the cameras were, which tells me it has to be somebody from the apartment complex or who visited there often.
Yeah, that makes sense.
A lady, now you asked me if anybody spoke with Prisma. A lady in the apartment complex stated that she had seen a woman matching Prisma's description standing near the back of a silver or gray car that had the trunk open, and that the woman she saw was crying. This woman who spotted the girl who looks like Prisma asked if she was okay. She gets a nod, and then the woman just continues on her way.
And did she see anybody else? Or, I mean, an open trunk to me implies that somebody else should be nearby.
Right.
And no one else was around?
No. And I actually asked Dan, because in several apartment complexes that I lived in graduate school, they had assigned parking spots based on the unit number.
Oh, yeah.
Like if you're
in
this apartment, you park here. And so I asked him if this apartment complex had those assigned parking spots. But he said that in all the times that he visited, he didn't see any designation of resident or non-resident parking. And he added that he doesn't believe that police ever identified whose car it was.
See, that's bothersome to me, because think about it. I mean, if that were me, that was my car, and I hear on the news that, and maybe they didn't hear about it, but, or from the apartment complex, or I hear on the news that there was someone near this car and it matches my description and I live in that building, I would probably reach out. And I remember having my trunk open for a certain period around that time. Like, I think it would be pretty easy for someone to know, oh, that was my car. And then they don't say anything.
And at least give the family that answer, that it wasn't connected.
And they may have seen her.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And since we don't know, we're just kind of left wondering, you know, what is up with the silver car? What was in the trunk? Does it have a link to Prisma? Was that even Prisma? Was she just completely disoriented? I mean, we have no idea.
Yeah. And the only thing, not to harp on the trunk being open. It's just weird to me. I was thinking maybe they were taking their groceries in and they just were like, oh, let me leave my trunk open between, which I would never do, but between trips.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make a ton of sense either. So it's just so strange. You'd think someone could identify who the owner of that car was. And it just from the basis of, hey, did you see anything? Did you see her? Because you probably would have been near your car at that time.
Yeah. And we actually, from that moment, we have from 6:01, no further pings from Prisma's phone. And Dan was actually told that Prisma's phone had died at 6:01. But what Dan brought up, and I've never tried this, but I thought it was interesting, is he said that Prisma had a line on her cell phone plan for her Apple Watch. So if her, even if her phone died, he wondered why she couldn't have called through her watch.
Oh, and can you track anything with the watch? I mean, I would think you could track activity. Did the watch activity stop at that point? She was wearing the watch, right?
Right. And so well, this is a point of contention, I think, because Dan said that she always wore an Apple Watch because he was just mesmerized when the first time she talked on her watch and showed that to him.
Yeah.
But he said he asked law enforcement that question and they were like, she didn't have an Apple Watch. She only had a Fitbit. But if they've never found her, how do they know? And he was like, no, she had a line on her cell plan.
Okay. Yeah. Like, I think he would know.
Right. Cadaver dogs, as well as search and rescue dogs, were brought to the scene and swabs were taken. Though I didn't read any details of hits that the dogs made or follow-ups that were done. But I do know some of the items that were searched or swabbed were the trigger of Prisma's gun, the grips, a water bottle. Stains were swabbed on the fifth floor of the garage. The fourth floor of the garage was searched. A vacant lot at Roseland and McCoy was searched. And the fifth floor of the apartment complex was searched. But I didn't read any details about what they found, if anything.
Oh, man, I would love to know, have that information, right, about if they tracked her scent, where it stopped, if it stopped somewhere. That could be really useful information. Or if they, you know, tracked it, as you're mentioning, where they search around the building somewhere. Yeah.
Well, here's what I want to know too. If she's in the parking garage, she could have easily been incapacitated and put in someone's trunk and they leave the apartment complex. So
yeah.
Were all of these cars that left shortly afterward checked? I don't know.
Did you say her phone died at 6:01?
That's what police told Dan.
And then he was saying she should have used her Apple Watch. But the phone, we know, did die, because that part has always been so weird to me, like the timing of it. Mm-hmm. It happens to die. But I mean, I can see why the battery would be drained. But then it happens to die and then she disappears at the same time.
At the exact moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Prisma's disappearance has been hard on all of her family, but especially so on her son, Dominic. Dan told Andrea Cavalier from NBC Dateline, quote, he's so intelligent for a six-year-old, but he's having a hard time understanding what's going on. He keeps asking for his mother. He knows something's wrong, but we're trying to just keep everything as normal as we can for him, end quote. And sadly, Sam, I mean, here we are years later, and we still don't have those answers to give Dominic.
I know. And it has to be so confusing as a child. It's confusing enough as an adult to even try to process these cases. So I can't imagine as a child not understanding where your mom is.
Yeah. What we do have are several theories that have been tossed around. So let's explore those a little bit now. Theory number one is that Prisma ran away. Most who are close to Prisma, they don't put much stock into this theory because they say there are two things that Prisma would never have abandoned. One is material, and the other one obviously is much more meaningful. But they said she would have never left her Jeep abandoned. And I mean, this makes sense that they discount this theory, because in my head, if your whole plan is to get away and to run away, why wouldn't you just drive the Jeep and get as far away as possible at first and then leave it somewhere?
Yeah, and she managed to do this in such a way that she would never be found again, like so cleanly, and yeah. When she seemed confused and scared, like right. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Now, some might argue that she was just involved in the road rage incident, and maybe she abandoned the car because she was scared of the repercussions of that incident. But the second thing that this theory would mean is that she abandoned something that can't be explained away, because she would never have abandoned her son, Dominic, not for any reason. Here is what Dan had to say about this theory.
And this is, well, this, which is not like her. A lot of people say, well, maybe she just left. I says, no, she wouldn't have just done that. She wouldn't have left Dominic all alone like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people find that hard to believe. I'm like, I'm telling you, she wouldn't have done that.
Right.
In that same article in The Sun, referenced earlier by Luke Kenton, Detective Barrett confirmed, quote, it would have been substantially out of her normal character to just disappear. We have a good read on her typical pattern of behavior and behavior changes later that evening, which leads us to believe something happens to her. As her family has said before, she would just never leave her son. He was her world, end quote. So even the police say, I don't know about this theory.
Yeah.
Theory right. number two is that Prisma committed suicide. This theory, too, obviously seems to be ruled out by most everyone for the same reason that the runaway theory is. And even though Prisma was extremely upset, just like everyone she spoke with that afternoon pointed out, Prisma doesn't have a history of depression. She doesn't have a history of mental illness. And I feel like she was definitely scared, but didn't seem suicidal to me.
Oh, I totally agree. She wasn't saying anything, as far as we know, that would indicate that that was even a thought for her at that time. And the timing, whenever this theory comes up in cases we cover, sometimes the timing just seems so strange to me. Mm-hmm. Like after this, like I get she had this bad day, but that's not, that doesn't equate to then choosing to die by suicide.
Right.
Like I don't think there's much weight to this. And then also she hasn't been found. So
right. Right. You can't hide your body. Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Theory number three, potential suspect Arturo. Arturo, Dominic's father, was investigated in Prisma's disappearance, but he has been ruled out by law enforcement as a suspect. I think a lot of people wanted to point a finger at him because he did seek sole custody after Prisma's disappearance. But Lilia Peralta, Prisma's mother, also stated that she doesn't believe that Arturo was involved in any way. Leah McDonald from Daily Mail wrote an article that was published on April 21st, 2019, saying, quote, speaking in Spanish, Peralta said that the child's father lived outside of Austin, and she does not believe he has anything to do with her, meaning Prisma's disappearance, end quote. So we don't really have a lot to go on with this theory, but people are like, oh, he sought sole custody of Dominic, which, I mean, would make sense for him to do.
Yeah, I agree. It, logistically, it just doesn't, that theory doesn't work out at all.
Theory number four, potential suspect, Ryan. Ryan was actually not home when Prisma arrived at his apartment complex and didn't return home until that evening. Now, this is according to his cell phone pings. There are those, Sam, who do still believe that he may have additional knowledge or still be involved for several reasons. Number one, obviously it is possible that someone else had Ryan's phone and was using it, and that's why the cell phone pings are elsewhere. Number two, where Ryan said he was that evening, which is his alibi, was that he had a date, but that date was only about a 10-mile drive from his apartment complex. So it wasn't like he, you know, went very far away.
Do you know if they corroborated that with the person he said he was on the date with, or if there was any video footage of this.
I am going to assume that they did, because even though those who believe that Ryan was somehow involved, they point out those things. They also point out, which does look a little bit sketchy, that Ryan moved away shortly after. And, you know, they point out that Prisma and Ryan had gotten into an argument at the bar just hours earlier. They had been in domestic violence situations before, mm-hmm. where Prisma had bruises. And so they wonder, could he have been angry? But the reason why I say it was probably corroborated is because with this theory, I do want to end by saying that law enforcement have not named him a suspect, and they have declared that his alibi up until midnight that night when he returned home was quote unquote solid.
Yeah, I mean, you can't argue with that much. I'm sure they've vetted it. And if they could corroborate where he was, it really does make it unlikely that he could have been involved, as appealing as it might be as a theory, considering she was last seen at his apartment and they didn't have the best history. You can't, I mean, if it just doesn't work out, if he was somewhere else, then that is what it is.
Right, exactly. Theory number five is that Prisma was the victim of human trafficking. In the area surrounding Ryan's apartment complex were some not-so-safe neighborhoods. So some wonder, like Dan, if Prisma had been drugged at the bar and followed. In fact, Dan told me that around the same time as Prisma disappeared, two other girls with similar descriptions as Prisma had gone missing in that same neighborhood. Now, I'm going to admit to you, I know we talked about it earlier, that I'm a little bit inclined to believe this theory, and here's why. I'll explain to you how my head is working. So one outlier detail in everything that I've told you about is a detail that was mentioned in a document that came to me directly from the private investigator hired by the family that I mentioned to you in passing earlier, that it is believed that Prisma mm-hmm. was hiding behind the dumpsters in the alley near the bar.
Right.
So that detail, it doesn't make sense to me unless she felt like someone was following her. So then in my mind, I'm thinking, would that explain why? And I know this seems crazy. This is a little bit off the wall. But could it explain why she maybe jumped from her car in the road rage incident? Because if she causes a scene, then maybe somebody who's following her would leave. I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't think about it that way.
It could explain why she had doubled back to head to Ryan's apartment if it were closer than her work. It would explain her confusion on the phone with other people if she were drugged, and her kind of desperate need to find out from Ryan his apartment number. It would explain why her Jeep was left parked haphazardly, why she ran into the gated community behind a car that was entering. What it doesn't explain, though, Sam, is why she didn't grab her gun, nor why she didn't mention her fear in her phone calls, unless, of course, she did, since law enforcement haven't revealed to the public what she was upset about on the phone that afternoon.
Yeah, that's a good point. It could tie in that way. I would also wonder, though, why she would just stand by that elevator for so long.
That is true. Unless she thought she had escaped them by running through the gate.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. But also, in the video footage, is she like looking out? Because I think it kind of looked like you could still see out on the street. Do we know if she was kind of looking around, or was it, from what I recall, she was just kind of on the phone?
Right.
But
yeah,
I don't know.
I don't know either. And then I feel like, I don't know, when we see her in the parking garage, she's walking, she's not running. So I don't know. Theory number six is some other foul play. Now, this kind of could tie into the human trafficking, might not. Strangely, between a year and a half to 2 years ago, Dan began receiving some rather off-putting phone calls that he still hasn't been able to explain.
About a year and a half ago, I guess it was. about a year and a half, between a year and a half, 2 years ago, I was receiving phone calls from Mexico. And it was all various times. It was anywhere between the hours of 9:30 and 3:30 in the morning. Nobody ever said anything. I used her name, her given name, the name she liked. I called her Prisma Denise, and Danica. You know, try to get any of those responses from those, because that was her stage name when she was dancing, was Danica. And nobody ever said nothing. Nothing was ever said. And then all of a sudden I would hear a door open or something like that and hear some voices in the background. All of a sudden the phone went dead. Now, to make a phone call from Mexico is not very cheap. And most of their phones then are all like prepaid phones. So the number went nowhere. I tried to look at it and it only goes so far, and then you get no information.
Whoa, okay, that's a strange detail.
Right.
Do you know, so you said he hadn't received those types of phone calls until she disappeared?
Right. And this was only about a year and a half to 2 years ago that he received these. So well after she had been missing.
Okay. So it wasn't like right after, but right. That's still really bizarre. I've never experienced something like that. In fact, I would be so creeped out. I mean, at least if it's a call from Mexico, it's not, you know, right down the street, but still, that's really strange and unsettling.
Yeah. Additionally, Dan speculated what the babysitter may know about what happened to Prisma. So first, he wonders why, if Prisma knew the babysitter through her mom, Lilia, why didn't the babysitter try to call Prisma's mom when she was wondering where Prisma might be before calling 911?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. And Dan also told me,
she did make comment, I do believe, you don't know who these people are. They're very dangerous people or something like that. That's another comment that she made that really stuck with me.
Okay. Well, that implies that she knows who is responsible.
Yes.
That's alarming.
So, Sam, what are your thoughts?
That comment you just added in.
I threw a curveball.
Threw me off. My initial thought, theory-wise, in this case would be that this was a crime of opportunity. Someone saw Prisma. To your point, it could have been they followed her to the apartment complex, or someone who lived there or was visiting saw Prisma in the state she was in, and maybe they tried, or maybe she tried to ask them for help. Maybe she tried to engage them in conversation, and it just happened to be someone with really bad intentions. The reason I kind of lean toward that is like never seeing her leave, right?
And
I kind of think it could have been someone who lived in the apartment. But then a totally off the wall theory is that, what if someone was driving really quickly through the parking garage and Prisma's kind of darting around, and she just comes out from in between two cars and someone hits her, then takes her. My problem with that is, first of all, then no one saw anything happen. I guess that's possible.
Right.
But second of all, you would think there'd maybe be some evidence of that left behind, like physical evidence. But I just keep going back to the phone kind of shutting off and dying right around the same time it seems like she disappears. And what I keep thinking is that this was a crime of opportunity, or an accident that turned into a crime, or like you suggested, maybe someone had been following her.
Right.
What do you think? You always have the best theories, Alice.
I'm torn because now, if she had been drugged, then it could explain why there are elements to her actions that don't fit, because she's not thinking clearly.
Right.
So it could explain why she ends up standing there, because she doesn't realize how much time has passed, or why she's not running, because maybe she thinks she is, you know? And so I keep in my mind, my gut going to that comment that Dan said the babysitter made about there being dangerous people, which does make me wonder, especially with two women with similar descriptions to Prisma going missing in that same neighborhood.
Yeah.
I feel like that's too, it's too much to be coincidence.
Right. I really don't like that comment from the babysitter.
Yeah.
Like, what do you know?
Right.
Can you share what you know?
Tell us.
I don't understand. Yeah.
While Dan had been very active in his efforts to find Prisma, unfortunately, because he is not a biological relative, there are limits to what he can request. For example, asking Texas Equisearch to step in. After running into roadblocks, the family finally got some much-needed help from a private investigator. The private investigator working with the family in Prisma's case recently requested several items. All CCTV footage and any other camera that was recording from the Olympus at Ross apartment parking garage from 2 p.m. to 7 a.m. the following morning, April 18th, 2019. She requested the body cam footage for all officers and detectives from the Olympus at Ross apartments and the parking garage of the apartment, from E-Bar as well, the footage, from canvassing, from searching the apartment and searching Prisma's Jeep, and any additional canvassing that was relevant to the case. She requested video of any potential witness statements throughout the first few days of the incident, along with any transcripts and audio recordings of any of the above. She requested any 911 calls made in regards to Prisma's disappearance, her whereabouts, and any other 911 call audio. She requested EMS transmissions and call logs in regards to those calls, and the full E-Bar video from the time Ryan got there until the time Prisma leaves in her Jeep. And finally, she requested proof that the Mesquite Police Department has been actively working this case every year for the last 4 years that Prisma has been missing in order to consider it an actual active case. The response from the city attorney of Mesquite, Texas, was the following, quote, "It is the city's belief that the law enforcement exception permits the city to exempt from public the requested records in their entirety. Although the incident has been currently listed as inactive, the investigation has not been fully closed and is pending further leads. Therefore, the city wishes to claim an exemption under the law enforcement exception to the Act, specifically under subsections 552.108A1 and or B1, end quote. So the city basically said, even though the case is inactive, they are refusing to turn over those pieces of evidence. My question is, did someone else in the apartment complex see something? Did they hear something? Is there someone who can fill in the blanks? Dan indicated that in one conversation with a detective, they insinuated that they only needed one more piece of information, one more key detail to fall into place before they could officially close Prisma's case. Are you the one who holds that answer? Prisma was last seen wearing a red polo with black stripes on the sleeves and on the shoulders, denim capris, black shoes with white soles, and carrying a black purse. She stands 5'2" and weighs roughly 135 pounds. She also sometimes wore glasses. Anyone with information concerning Prisma Denise Peralta Reyes or her disappearance is asked to call the Mesquite Police Department at 972-285-6336. And I'd like to end with Dan's pleas for your help.
I just ask anybody that might be listening to this, you know, no matter how small a tidbit of information might be, you might think it's unimportant. Please, any and all information, if this triggers a memory or something like that, or something of a such, please contact either, you know, our website, Where's Prisma Reyes, or contact the Mesquite Police Department, and please pass that information on. It just, that one little thing that somebody might think of, that might be the one little key thing we need to finish putting all this together to bring her home. That's, you know, I'm not asking for myself or her mother or anybody else. I'm asking for her son. Yeah, because he's unable to do that right on his own because he's, of course, not old enough. But that, you know, if you can think of anything, no matter how minuscule you think it might be, please give us all the information. We're taking in any lead we get. We try to follow it up as far as we can.